trying to talk about the cessation of suffering or the end of the world or no self, it can be very, very misleading. People misunderstand because the commitment very much to the world, to the realm of grasping and desire, suffering, to a sense of the self. And so, to oftentimes Christians, we sound like nihilists, like we're just aiming at it in a kind of vacuous state of annihilation. And even that's how it might seem, you know, when one thinks about it, you think of no self, no personality, end of the world, consciousness ceases. What's left? Is that what we're here for? Just to no longer exist, not be anyone, have no desires, not be born again. And then fear comes up in the mind, fear and terror about not existing. Because fear and desire work together. And if one is attached to desire, one's going to be frightened. If desire and fear are the worldly conditions. They keep the world arising and ceasing. And as long as one is caught in desire and fear, then the world will be arising and ceasing, but it won't end. You won't even notice that the world has ceased, because you, as soon as one world ceases, you create another one. Now the refuge in Buddha Dhamma Sangha, this implies, this is the best one can do with words and concepts. A refuge in mindfulness, in knowing, and in truth, and in virtue. So that doesn't mean annihilation, does it? We're not saying we're trying to just become totally kind of wiped out, vanish, invisible nothings. Because then what's the point of being virtuous? What's the Sangha about? If we're just aiming at annihilation and invisibility and so forth, there's no point in being good or doing anything, really. Why not commit suicide? What's the point of being awake? Buddha, Bhutang Sanangachami. What's the point of being awake and aware with wisdom if it's just nothing, annihilation, a void, a vacuum? Now notice that we can conceive a vacuum and a void and nothing, like no thing at all, or a total annihilation. It's a concept, isn't it? Total destruction and annihilation is a thought in the mind. But when that thought ceases, or when the thought of an eternal, a place of where if we were sitting here trying to find a heaven where we could be happy forever. Heavenly happiness forever and ever, where me, Sumedho Bhikkhu, myself and my soul, can live with you in a kind of childlike paradise, playing on the grass and drinking lemonade, petting the deer and feeding the squirrels and the ducks, and kind of... I mean, even on a sunny day in England, we don't do that very much, do we? But yet, the images of paradise have been a kind of childlike realm of where you're protected and safe, and everything is nice and sweet and pretty, and no ugliness, no snake in the garden, no worms in the apple, no flies in the ointment. There's none of these primordial serpents either, these seven-headed nagas, or imagine what those would do in child's paradise. Fire-breathing dragons. And that when you're a child, you think of paradise as being locked into a sweet shop for the night. Remember one time they had this little penny candy store in the place where I lived in Seattle when I was a little boy. And in those days you could buy a bag, little bag, brown bags of candies. Where you got a few pennies, you could get a whole bag full of these. And licorice cigars. And I had this fascination for licorice cigars. Now one day I think my mother gave me 5 cents, a nickel in American terms. That's a lot of money in those days for a little boy, and I went up to this candy store and bought 5 cents worth of licorice cigars, which were maybe about five of these things. And then I raced out of the store and started chewing them or eating them all up, and I got sick at my stomach. Threw it all up, all these. For years after that, I couldn't stand licorice. What kind of paradise is that? And yet, to my mind, when I was thinking of it, anticipating, wouldn't it be wonderful if one licorice cigar is delicious? Well, I mean, if you could have all you want, a non-ending, non-ceasing supply of licorice cigars. You know, not the cigars you smoke, the kind you eat. I wasn't into smoking when I was little. Well, that taught me something, that getting everything you want and being able to indulge your appetites, to gorge them and satiate them, only leads to throwing up. Well, that's some wisdom, isn't it? When you're a child, you do learn that the result of eating too many liquor cigars is that you get sick at your stomach and throw it all up. And your fetish fascination for licorice stops. You can't stand it anymore. Hell, when I was a child, was falling down and skinning my knees and having to put mercurochrome on my knees. It was very painful. My mother put this kind of stinging red mercurochrome, iodine, on my knees, skin knees. That'd be very painful. That'd be kind of hell realm. You anticipate it. She's going to put that mercurochrome on my knees this time. Before she's even doing it, you're gritting your teeth. Possibility of pain, stinging pain. And then you found out that you could take it, the stinging pain of mercurochrome on your skin knees. So the sensory realm is like this. It's a realm of where sense what is attractive and desirable and what is anticipated with dread or fear. That we can live our lives very much in just the realm of, in a hell realm, of fear and anxiety and worry about the possibilities of mercurochrome on our skin knees or getting cancer or losing something we love, or being separated, or being in a crash. And then the desire for the security that these things will not happen, that everything will be all right. And then the ability to reflect on this, on these two extremes of both the dreading and fearing and desiring for happiness and pleasure and security, to just observe this whole mental process as it really is and let it go, letting it cease. So the cessation of the world is the relinquishment of fear and desire. Rather than I'm trying not to exist as a person. I just want out. I just want to get off the merry-go-round. I don't want to play the games. I want to get out of it all. I don't want to exist. I don't want to be. Not that. It's letting things go, allowing things to be without being deluded, no longer being deluded by the appearances, the way it all seems, the way we've been conditioned to perceive. Memory then is very much coming, when memory is an attachment, when we're attached to sanya, khanda, or perception, then of course this is where we begin to dread. And if I think of just remembering eating licorice cigars when I was 5 years old, I can remember that now. Now if I'm attached to the memory, and the ability to and the identity of a self, then all these things accumulate over the years of one's life. One has the memories of the traumatic experiences. Why don't I remember something else about being six years old? There's only a few things I can remember, that being one of them, because I threw up. Something that I was looking forward to as being something that's going to be really wonderful. So it was an extreme moment, wasn't it? 5 cents worth of liquor, cigars, a dream come true, reached heaven at last, and I threw up. Well, obviously that memory, one could maybe see that as a kind of bitter reminder of things, and it could have maybe, you know, by accumulation of these memories of throwing up and being disappointed with life, I could be a bitter old man at 54, couldn't I? Life is just vomit, that's all it is. Even when you get what you want, it's nothing but puke. A bitter old man, because when I was 5 years old, and then a whole series of other incidents that's just one of the first ones, and then after that it got worse and worse. It wasn't just with licorice cigars, but it was with everything else. Some disappointment, you're expecting a lot and it all disappointed you. You're expecting to have a really, when you finish university, when I get my degree, then I'll be really happy. But then you have to try to get a job. When I get the job, the profession, then I'll be really happy. And then get that, and then if something goes wrong there, and then by the time you're 54, what a disappointment it's all been. From liquor, cigars to unemployment, to redundancy, to divorce, to whatever. The world is a terrible place. Hate it. Disappointment. Or maybe the memories are more positive. I have some very happy memories of the good times, the successes, the great moments. the important, meaningful relationships and experiences of life. But then, when you're 54, if you're looking forward to more kind of meaningful relationships and interesting adventures and fascinating experiences, you realize that, I mean, by this time you've had enough of it. At least I have. What, more kind of romances or kind of interesting and meaningful relationships with people, or go more places and see more kind of ruins and castles and what is there to do when you're 54? You know, in the world of adventures and romances and excitement. Well, one could think, but by now it's no longer, one kind of doesn't want to do that. It's not very interesting, not very attractive to think of spending more years trying to squeeze enjoyment out of these kind of things. So even if one has been successful and had a happy life, age itself presents its own kind of interesting outlook. It's a Devaduta, isn't it? The old age, sickness and death, are the messengers that remind us that this realm here, this sensory realm, is to be studied and observed, but not to be grasped. We learn from it, we investigate it, we examine it, but if you grasp it, you're going to be terribly disappointed, lost, frightened, upset, despairing, and anguished, because this sensory realm is this way. It's not to be anything to grasp. It's something you just learn from and notice as it goes along. It's an ever-changing flow and movement, the sensory realm. And so we find out how to just observe the flow, the flux of change of this sensory realm, to be with the changingness of it, rather than to try to find any point in it that we try to hold on to. It's learning to flow along with it, to be with the flow of it, the flux and the movement and change, to be the change itself, to no longer resist change, but to allow that which is changing to change and be what it is. So emptiness and no self isn't a vacuum of annihilation, but it's the peace and the happiness of non-resistance, and of being able to learn and know and see and realize truth. When we resist change and want this, I mean, the personality view is always resisting something, isn't it? I don't like this and I don't want that. The opinions we have, why does the world have to be this way? Why does it have to change? I don't want to grow old. I don't want to get sick. I don't want to die. I don't want my friends to die. I don't want anyone to suffer. I don't want people to get old, and I don't want the world to be the way it is. I don't want to skin my knees, and I don't want mercurochrome to burn, and I don't want to throw up when I eat licorice cigars. I want to eat licorice cigars and not throw up. And I want that's an impossibility, isn't it, to just eat licorice cigars all the time without throwing them up. Because that's the way it is. I don't want the English weather to be the way it is. I don't want the world to be like it is. I don't want to be the way I am. I want to become something. I want you to become something. And so this way of thinking is coming from the Sakkayaditti viewpoint of self, of me and mine, which is a resistance to the change. Because when you think of yourself, it's an illusion of a kind of permanent self-quality, isn't it? When you let go of the thought of self, then the things are just in the flow and change. It's the way it is. Anicca. When we allow the change and the flow, I mean, it goes on anyway, whether we allow it or not, but when we're with it, when we open to it, then there's no self, and then there's no suffering. No dukkha, no self. This afternoon at tea time, talking about the Coronation Street in EastEnders and Dallas. These are reflections, aren't they, of human desires and ways of the people can occupy their time with the trivialities of our human existence, the problems that people have, the quarrels that men and women have with each other. I remember sitting on an airplane one time watching this movie, and I didn't have earphones or anything. I was just sitting there, and this thing was on the screen, so I didn't hear any sound. But every so often there'd be a quarreling scene. Well, I haven't had romantic affairs for years, you see, so I forgot all about what goes on in romantic affairs. And in the movies, these romantic affairs, this is a romantic movie, every so often, every few minutes, this young man and woman were at each other, quarreling, telling each other off, or running away from each other, and then running to each other and embracing. An hour and a half of this, where you're just watching the thing without the sound. And you see the actress, she's falling in love, and he's falling in love with her, and they're kind of embracing, and that you can't, they can't have an hour and a half of just happy embracing, can you? And it wouldn't, nobody would want to see that. A whole hour and a half of just this man and woman embracing each other and smiling. So they had to have them separate and misunderstand each other and have fights, and she tells him off, and he tells her off, and she runs away, and he chases after her, and she tries to throw herself off a bridge, and he saves her. I'm sure you know the plot. I think, why do people want to do all that? Why do they? What is that? Do that people sit there and watch this stuff, and they actually maybe engage in it sometimes in your life. You go through these things, but it is very much an expression of a self view. And I want, I don't want, and I want you. I want you to be this way. I don't want you to be that way. It should be, you know, it should be that the man and the woman, the young man and woman, come together and they fall in love and live happily ever after. The Cinderella theme. But then you can't just have, I mean, you've got to have a bit of suspense and so forth to make it entertaining. Because meeting, falling in love, and living happily ever after is pretty boring to most people. You have to have misunderstandings, obstacles, frustrations, ordeals and trials, and then finally win out in the end, hopefully. Or maybe it's tragedy, where through misunderstandings she throws herself off a bridge and he dies of an overdose of heroin or something. And that leaves you like, that's the bitter old man, 50-year-old man. Life is just throwing up. And life is just a terrible disappointment, misunderstandings, and no way of solving the problems. Or the Cinderella theme, where everything works out and everybody's happy in the end. But in the religious quest, all this ceases, the happiness, the bitterness, all these romances, adventures, excitement, the fascination for the conditions, the identity with the world, and the seeking to keep creating a world that one is creating one's own world out of fear and desire. Now the bliss and the peace of letting the world end isn't jumping off the bridge or dying of an overdose of heroin, but it's allowing these illusions to cease, to know the way things are, what arises ceases, the conditions are this way. Now with mindfulness, which is the way out of suffering, mindfulness is the only way that we can actually be in tune and in touch with the flow of things. Otherwise, we're busy trying to indulge or suppress or get caught up into these conditions as if they were something more than just conditions, as if they were really mine, or that they should be some other way, or they shouldn't be the way they are. Well, mindfulness then is mindfulness and wisdom, sati sampajanya, sati panya. This what we've been doing on this retreat is learning to develop this way of reflection. This is the way it is. When things, misunderstandings happen here at Amaravati, people's feelings get hurt and people misunderstand things and so forth. This is just the way the world is. We're not expecting Amaravati to be perfect either. We can see that there can be misunderstandings, there can be hurt feelings, pride and egos get battered here. Lack of proper communication takes place, and we can have all kinds of views and opinions about what it should be. But rather than making any problems about it, we can observe it. For us, it's a very simple way, isn't it? For the samanas. Because we can reflect that we have robes, alms food, shelter for the night, medicine for illness, moral precepts, we have moral protection, and our intention is to do good, to develop virtue, the science of the good. So in that way, the conditions around us are to be studied and examined rather than to be criticized and despised or exalted. We work with the way things are. because we have everything we need for the holy life. This teaching is very difficult to understand sometimes. People and monks and nuns and so forth can really, even after quite a few years, still not quite get it. Because it begins to, it takes time to really absorb, to really see it. I mean, one can figure it out quite easily in the beginning. Most of you figured it out in the beginning. But then the habit formations can be quite strong, and the urgent worldly, like the Coronation Street traumas and crescendos, can be so overwhelming that you forget. Does Valerie really love Nigel? Or does Nigel, is he really in love with Rosemary? And Rosemary doesn't really care much for Nigel, but she's got this kind of fascination for Valerie. All this can take on great importance, can't it? What will happen to Valerie, Nigel, and Rosemary? No exit, isn't it? Remember that play by Sartre? A kind of no exit situation where you're stuck in this realm of misunderstanding, cross communications, blockages, fixations, and there's no exit. It's just stuck in this realm of fear and desire. That's the way the world is. It seems like there's no way out sometimes. It's just, you're just stuck in a realm of confusion and hopelessness, and you hope people will understand, and then they don't, and then things go off and go wrong, and this fails, and then we get old and people die, and so that in the Coronation Street, the obsession with the world is, we just have to keep kind of hoping for the best. And a kind of stiff upper lip, carry on, you know, because, you know, you don't know what's going to happen, but you just hope that everything will be all right. Get the monks to chant for you. Say your prayers every night. Give to the blind and hope for the best. But all this ceases in the mind, doesn't it? And we're beginning to realize the peace of cessation is not a dismissal or an irresponsible not caring or no longer thinking it, just trivializing and making fun of Coronation Street, of the worldly problems and the passions and melodramas that people have in their lives. But it's the ability to see them in the perspective of what they really are. They're no longer deluding us. Because we investigate Dhamma, we see that all that arises ceases and is not self. So the cessation of all these melodramas is a relief, isn't it? Not to have to be Rosemary or Valerie or Nigel. Not having to let them cease, you know, the way at the exit is letting it all cease. Valerie, Nigel, Rosemary, become enlightened. Problem solved, isn't it? Nigel realizes that his love for Valerie realizes that her love for Nigel is really just a selfish indulgence, part of it, and a neurotic need to have to find security, because her father left when she was only 2 years old, and her mother had to work hard scrubbing floors. Or maybe Valerie really realizes that love is not particularly isn't an attachment, but the ability to let go, not to make a problem about what happened in the past or about what she would like to have in the future, but to just not make any problems, not create anyone called Nigel and hang on. And Nigel begins to realize that he really loves Valerie and Rosemary. But it's not a selfish, egotistical love or demand, but the love of a heart that is free from any selfish interest. All he wants for them is for them to keep the moral precepts and develop virtue. That Nigel frees himself from any kind of desire and fear. So in the no exit situation, there is an exit, the end of suffering, by not making problems, not creating people. Like here at Amaravati, if we create if we really believe in the creations of our mind, then we create no exits, can't we? We think, oh, this is never going to change. What about the nuns and the monks? And this person is like this, and that person is like that. And what are you going to do if this person died? If this person died, what if Ajahn Sumedho should suddenly drop dead? What do we do? Who'll be the next senior monk? And these are all no exit situations we're creating. Ajahns and senior monks and nuns and juniors and anagarikas and lay people and whose duty is to who and who likes who and who doesn't like who and who's going to do what to who and what should we do if this happens or that happens. And so this is the no exit. You're getting stuck in this realm of fear and desire. And it's the monuments of unaging intellect, isn't it? Just creations of our mind, just intellectual perceptions that become monuments, kind of permanent fixtures that we believe are reality. But when we let go, then they all cease. And the ability and the knowing, the awareness, the peace that comes from knowing the end of the world. The world ends. When the world ends, there's peace. And when there's peace, there's no problem. All the problems are solved. They cease because we don't create them. And there's still love. It doesn't mean that Nigel doesn't love Valerie or Rosemary anymore. Or Rosemary's love for Valerie is no longer a kind of neurotic need. The love that dare not speak its name, whatever. They, it is, but it's the love of knowing, of truth, virtue, love of virtue. Loving each other in this community means that we really help each other. We seek to help and free each other from attachment, not to bind each other with neurotic problems and limit each other and misguide each other and exploit each other, which oftentimes it goes under the name of love in these melodramas. But love in this sense, if you're talking about love from the purity of being, of the heart, then it is the love we have for each other by the love of morality and of virtue, of our intention, the spiritual life. It's not based on liking somebody's personality anymore, but something transcending all that, much finer, more beautiful, more, and something truly perfect. So we're not being bitter cynics by saying there's no love, it's just anatta, no self, and we just want to get out of this existence, end of the world, end of consciousness, bye-bye cruel world. A kind of soulless, selfless, nihilistic Buddhist position. But one begins to realize what love really is. The warmth, the kindness, the respect, the way we free each other, help each other, support each other, take care of each other. Not because we like each other's personalities, or I think Valerie is super, but Rosemary's not so great, or I prefer Valerie to Rosemary, or prefer Nigel to Valerie, or prefer Rosemary to Nigel, or today I like Rosemary and tomorrow I don't like her anymore, I like Nigel. That's all very, very fraught with licorice cigars and McCreary-Chrome. Isn't it? So no self, anatta, is not a sterile, sterilized mind where we just don't care and don't see and don't notice each other, or just regard each other in the most kind of cold and indifferent ways. But the freedom of loving, sharing, giving, helping, supporting, without fear and without desire. These that we let go of, they cease. So we can see in the Buddhist teaching, it's a teaching to get to point to what is the real problem, this attachment, this delusion, the avijja, and all that is produced from that is a world of misery, a world of throwing up, a world of stinging, burning pain, a world of despair, of bitterness, of fear that even if we're happy, we're going to lose it, because avijja, bhajaya, sankhara can only produce these kind of very, very difficult, complicated worlds. So the end of the world is a relief rather than a tragedy. No self is a relief rather than an annihilation. So contemplate this in this way of reflecting. It's quite a skillful way to think, isn't it? When we contemplate in this way, no longer. Seeing the world as the material world, but as the world of avijja, bhajaya, sankhara. the world ceases, then there's peace. There's knowing. There's intelligence. And these lovely Brahma Viharas manifest through and appear and touch and move and flow with the way things are, rather than this terrible realm of me and mine, which is fraught with fear and desire, limitation, resistance, pain, despair, and death. So I offer this for your reflections.